So our topic for this morning is marijuana, alcohol, and the Jewish community. This is a topic that obviously became big a few years ago when they started to discuss legalization, the issue of recreational marijuana use, but it's an ongoing topic. Unfortunately, the Jewish community is not immune from the ills of addiction. But also, the Jewish community seems to have something of a split personality on this, in the sense that when I talk to people about recreational marijuana use, I tend to get a response. I'm not sure what I'll get in this room, but I tend to hear people say recreational, not medical, but recreational is inappropriate. Even if it becomes legal, it's not something we would do for reasons that we'll talk about. And then I ask them about kiddush. I don't know if there's a thing here. Is there such a thing here as... Oh, people can please turn off their phones. Marjorie announced it before, but it always bears repeating. Is there a phenomenon here called a kiddush club?
Oh, yes.
A kiddush club. For those who are not familiar, could someone give me a little bit of explanation of what a kiddush club is? All right, maybe that's a few different explanations at the same time. Let's try that again. The Kiddush Club, as I am familiar with it, is a group that tends to be present for services and then suddenly not to be present for services. Usually around the time of the Haftorah, the end of the Torah reading, they will vanish mysteriously from the main shul and to be found perhaps in a classroom somewhere or a coat room or somewhere in the synagogue facility, and they will enjoy whiskey, snacks, good conversation, and then eventually wander back into services. This is what we're talking about. And I wonder, in communities in which we frown on, and I think it is traditionally frowned on, the idea of drug use, why is it that this kind of gathering, you know, during services as well, but just in general, why is this okay? Or is it? Well, why is it accepted? Not why is it okay, but why is it accepted? Why does it, in fact, go on? Yes? Because people don't eat before davening. That's actually a very important point, is that when people come in for services, ideally they're coming in not having eaten that morning. And if so, you know, people get hypoglycemic, there's a need, so let's have some whiskey, because that's the first thing you want. Right? Because if you're hungry, you might as well get dehydrated too. No, that's not why? Yes?
Is this
Kiddush
Club, is it mostly men?
The ones that I am familiar with tend to be mostly male. Well, I don't participate, so I don't know. But I'll say mostly male. So this is something that I want to get to talk about here. What is this about? The hypoglycemia is an issue. And it's important to note that if somebody really would be endangering their health by not eating before services, they should eat before services. So that's fairly straightforward. But there is a difference between bringing a little grape juice and a cookie so that you can be safe, you know, through services, and asking the rabbi maybe to shorten the speech a little bit, right? And saying, we're going to have 5, 10, 15 of us going out in the coat room for 20 minutes and, you know, enjoy some whiskey conversation. So I want to show you first along the way. Source number one. I love this article. I first saw this article. I was a guest at somebody's house and they have it at National Geographic around. I picked it up and lo and behold, this was in it. High science seeks to unlock marijuana secrets. They're talking about the development of marijuana and the science of it. Then one day in 1963, a young organic chemist in Israel named Rafael Mishula, working at the Weizmann Institute of Science outside Tel Aviv, decided to peer into the plant's chemical composition. He's talking about cannabis. Further testing found what the world now knows. This compound, the compound that he's talking about, is the plant's principal active ingredient, its mind-altering essence, the stuff that makes you high. Mishulam, along with a colleague, had discovered THC. For these breakthroughs and many others, Mishulam is widely known as the patriarch of cannabis science, which is a good title to put on your resume. In 1968, 1992, Michelin's quest for quantification led him from the plant itself to the inner recesses of the human brain. That year, he and several colleagues made an extraordinary discovery. They isolated the chemical made by the human body that binds to the same receptor in the brain that THC does. Michelin named it anandamide, from the Sanskrit for supreme joy. When asked why he didn't give it a Hebrew name, he replied, "It's because in Hebrew there are not so many words for happiness." I thought that was a crisis. No, it's not true. Sorry. I've got Hebrew speakers here. I know you. Andy, what else? Osher. Good. Osher with an olive. Osher with an eye and can't buy your happiness.
Yeah.
Osher with an olive is happiness. How about Sason? How about Gila? How about Chedva? Right? We have loads of words that connote happiness. This fellow, Meshulam, I was going to say I don't know what he was smoking, but I do know what he was. This fellow, Rav Meshulam, insists that Judaism doesn't like being happy. Now, it's true. We do excel at guilt. This is very true. And there is an element in Judaism of recognizing suffering and even finding value in it. So that is also true. Nonetheless, I consider it a little bit of an injustice that he decided to name it anandamide. And he couldn't have thought of some Hebrew word that he could have used in association with it. But the Israel connection is fascinating and continues today because, in fact, a lot of contemporary marijuana growth, medical and otherwise, actually is, in fact, going on in Israel today. But what I want to ask, without getting into Woody Allen, type territory, is it okay to take a substance, marijuana or alcohol, that's meant to remove inhibitions, to relax the mind, knowing that it can come with serious medical risks? That is really what we're talking about here. And what I want to do is go back to those two parts that I mentioned before, as we started, which is number one, I think the Jewish tradition and the establishment is against recreational drug use. And I want to ask why that is, what are the concerns? And then move from that to the question of why alcohol is so big in synagogue life, because it is. Dr. David Palkovitz, very accomplished psychologist, who tells the following story about a synagogue where he had consulted with the synagogue and their board about alcohol use within the synagogue and the possibility of, in fact, going dry, as certain New York synagogues have done in recent years. Simply saying, grape juice for kiddush, and that's it. No alcohol within the synagogue. Yes, I'm trying to start a movement. So he said that the synagogue president at this particular synagogue laughed and said, no way, it's not going to go. It's not necessary here at all. Synagogue president calls him back a week later. Now he's on board. What happened? He had gone with his son to a basketball game. And they're sitting in the stands at the basketball game. And they're a couple of rows over, some rowdy guys who were, making jokes, speaking a little inappropriately, generally speaking, acting foolish. They clearly had a few too many beers. And he had said to his son, see what happens, look over there, see what alcohol does. And he turns to his father and he says, that's what you look like when you come back from the kiddush club. The kids see. They're aware. So, I want to I'm like 6 minutes in, but this is a very long sheet. There's a lot of stuff on here. We're not going to be going through everything, from the text that's there, but I read it because I think it's interesting reading. But the first point that I wanted to make, which involves, sources 2 through 4, is that I'm not talking about medical marijuana use. There is ample basis in Judaism, in Jewish law, in Jewish tradition, for permitting use of strong medication, to deal with pain, to deal with loss of appetite, to deal with nausea, all the things that medical marijuana is meant to be used for. And I'm not weighing in on the scientific evidence. I'm not, I'm not a doctor, not pretending to be one. Speak to your doctor about it. But we have a passage in the Talmud in number 2, which talks about the idea that a nazir might be considered sinful. What is a nazir? Sorry, someone who doesn't drink, among other things. And a nazir, translated very helpfully in English as a Nazirite, is somebody who has taken a vow, the rules of which include not drinking, not coming in contact with the dead, and not cutting their hair. It could be a man, could be a woman, and they finish their cycle of being a nazir, and then they bring certain offerings. And at one point, it seems like the Torah describes the nazir as having sinned. Masher chata al hanefesh is the phrase that the Torah uses. And so there's some discussion about whether a nazir, in fact, should take such a vow or not. Generally speaking, why do you think someone would take such a vow? What would motivate that?
Feeling
they've done something wrong beforehand, and now they need to atone for it. Often, as understood by the sages mentioned in the Talmud, it comes out of a feeling of needing to assert control over oneself. A feeling that they're going off on a path they shouldn't be, you need to rein yourself in. So the Talmud describes somebody who was so taken by their own beauty that they felt they were losing control of their behavior and said, you know what, I need to take a step back. And part of being a nazir is to grow one's hair very long. Then the conclusion of the period of being a nazir, they shave it all off. And there's an element of self-abnegation that goes along with it. But if you see what I brought there in number 2, the suggestion is made Talmudically that the nazir has sinned by painting himself by withdrawing from wine. Meaning that you're not supposed to pursue pain. There are restrictions in the Torah for our behavior. However, we don't go looking for extra restriction, and we certainly don't go looking for pain. And as a result, you find positions, some which I brought you here in number 3 and in number 4, that take the stand that drug use in order to eliminate otherwise intractable pain would be acceptable. Rabbi J.K. Blank in number 3, and then the OU, the Orthodox Union, in number 4, justifying putting a stamp of kosher supervision on marijuana products, saying that if it's done for medical uses, that's actually an imperative. So we're not talking about medical today. That's not our discussion. What we're talking about is recreational. So let's say somebody has said the following to you. I am a spiritual seeker. I am looking for religious growth, but I feel very inhibited in the course of my life. And I think that if I were to use marijuana, if I were to use LSD, I would be able to achieve great highs, not only great highs in the druggy sense, but spiritually. I'd be able to connect with God. What would you say to that person? No, I don't want to hear what you say.
It's a rationalization.
It's a rationalization.
Are you going to be rational communicating
on that stuff? Well, hopefully, if they're communicating with God, so hopefully they can.
But
is this going to take you out of that practice? Well, take a look at source number 5. Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, also known as the Seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, was approached regarding this question back in 1964. Makes sense. In 1964, he was asked about using LSD in order to get closer to God. Look at his answer. I thought it was fascinating. He says, I am in receipt of your letter of October 18th, which you write in the name of your friends, naturally, and in your own behalf, and ask my opinion regarding a new drug called LSD, which is said to have the property of mental stimulation, etc. Biochemistry is not my field, and I cannot express an opinion on the drug you mention, especially as it is still new. However, what I can say is that the claim that the said drug can stimulate mystical insight, etc., is not the proper way to attain mystical inspiration, even if it has such a property. The Jewish way is to go from strength to strength, not by means of drugs and other artificial stimulants, which are in place only if they are necessary for the physical health, in accordance with the mitzvah to take care of one's health. I hope that everyone will agree that before any drugs are taken, one should first utilize all one's natural capacities, and when this is done truly and fully, I do not think there will be a need to look for artificial stimulants. There are lots of other ways for you to find spiritual inspiration. LSD is not necessarily on that list. And he says, I trust you and your group, in view of your yeshiva background, have regular appointed times for the study of Torah and the inner aspects of the Torah, namely the teachings of Hasidus, Hasidic thought, and that such study is in accordance with the principle of our sages, namely the essential thing is the deed, the actual conduct of the daily life in accordance with the Torah and its soul, prayer, tefillin, kashrut, etc. This is only a matter of will and determination, for nothing stands in the way of the will. I trust that you are using your good influence throughout your environment. So he says, no, basically. He just says no, to quote the ad campaign. He's not a fan. He doesn't believe that this is what the path that one should pursue, despite the fact that they claim to have very proper spiritual, altruistic intentions. Let's move away from using it for a spiritual high, where he points out there are other needs. What about recreational use is it that disturbs us? What is it about recreational drug use where somebody says, I want to enjoy myself? Yeah, I was on a panel in 2017 to discuss the issue of recreational drug use, and specifically there were a lot of parents were there. So one of the questions of the panelists was, do you feel like you're going to be able to say no when your child wants to try this, given that the government is now going to say this is legal? I thought that was an interesting question to ask, because I've never had a problem before saying no to things that the government says are legal. Right? The government says a lot of things are legal. It's my job as a parent to say, okay, the government says it's legal, but not in my house. Right? That's the way it works. Yeah.
Well, if at the age of 14 you're going to drive a car, it's not legal until you're...
Well, I'm not looking to halt my say in what my children do at the age of 14, right? Even when they reach the age where the government says this is okay, I'm still not okay with it. But the question then is, so what do you tell your child? What is the reason besides because I said so? Yes?
Well, the way I did it, I don't like to have my brain messed with. I like to think clearly and speak clearly. If your brain is messed with, either with alcohol or drugs, and they're all girls, in my case, you don't know what's going to happen to you, and you don't know what's going to be. Mm-hmm. And I want you to have a clear mind wherever you are. And so far,
so loss of rationality and loss of control are the two elements that Marlene mentions. Good. I saw.
Same with liquor as well.
And that's where we have to go with this, which is, so if you don't like it with drugs, why is it okay with alcohol? So we have to come back to the alcohol question. We haven't touched that yet. So those are two issues. Yes?
It could be very scary. It could be laced with fentanyl.
Right. So this is another aspect. Safety. Now, you're talking about safety in terms of the potential contamination, in terms of it coming from an improper source. But what about safety overall? There's a huge health component here. And I talked to quite a few doctors at the time of legalization, and all of them felt this was a terrible idea, and all of them pointed out that he didn't have scientific testing yet. Because it was illegal, you didn't have the decades of testing that showed the harm that comes to smoking cigarettes. Right? How in the world do you know that this is actually a safe thing to do? Take a look at source number 6, please. Article from a journal, Therapeutic Advances in Psychopharmacology. Article on cannabis, as it's called, Cannabis, a Complex Plant. Cannabis is a complex plant with over 400 chemical entities, of which more than 60 of them are cannabinoid compounds, some of them with opposing effects. Cannabis is also the most widely used illicit drug in the world. Its use has been associated with various mental health problems, particularly in the young. Despite the links made between its use and the development of mental health problems, it is also known that not everyone who uses it is affected adversely in the same way. Some people have worse results. Some people do not. There's a lot of literature about use by teens and people in their early 20s when the brain is still developing, and how it can lead to psychotic episodes for the rest of their lives when they're not using. But it doesn't matter. The use that they had when they were younger is already affecting them in ways that are going to hit them for life. It can trigger psychological disorders in people who have a genetic predisposition. What about the lung cancer concerns? You're putting all of these compounds in your lungs if you smoke it, and it hasn't been tested. This is, I emphasize here, a concern of halacha, of Jewish law. This isn't only about a matter of personal choice, and here are factors that one should consider. First of all, Jewish law greatly values saving and protecting life. Right? We have a biblical command, v'nishmartem me'od l'nafshoteichem. You have a great responsibility to protect your life. That's sort of square one as a calculation. Someone comes to me on Shabbat and says that, God forbid, somebody in their household fell down the stairs and hit their head, and they don't know whether they need to go to the hospital, don't need to go to the hospital. My answer is, go to the hospital. So why am I erring on the side of caution on Shabbat, right, and saying, break Shabbat in order to go to the hospital, but I'm willing to take a risk with an untested drug? That doesn't make any sense. The system that says, do what you need to do to protect life, also says, don't take risks that are so clearly at odds with protecting life. Not to mention, let's go back to another point that was mentioned, take a look at number 7, where I'm out of these notes. Having a healthy, whole body is among the paths of God. One can neither understand nor know anything about God when ill. Therefore, one must distance himself from anything which damages the body. One must accustom himself to behaviors which increase health and strength. You have a responsibility to protect your health for religious reasons. And that became the primary basis for prohibiting drug use over the years. So Moshe Feinstein wrote it in number 8. He was approached by a yeshiva that wanted to know how to deal with students who were, in fact, into drug use. This was in the 1970s. And he says, it's obvious this is prohibited because of several biblical legal principles. First, it corrupts and destroys the body. Even if there are healthy people who are not harmed to that extent, it still corrupts the mind. They can't understand concepts fully. This is even more serious. He says, he's not willing to accept it. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in Israel, in source number 9, takes the same approach. Rabbi Ezra Bonsri, a little more recently in Israel, took the same approach. All of them are concerned about this. There's a rabbi in Israel by the name of Rabbi Ephraim Zalman Novitz who wrote a book called Alcoholism V'Samim B'Yahadut, which means alcoholism and drugs in Judaism. And he noted a passage in the Talmud which seems to be an antecedent for this. If you take a look at source number 11, it's fascinating. Rabbi Chava, son of Rabbi Hanina, said, one who regularly uses ketzach will never come to heartache. Ketzach is black cumin, it seems. So the Talmud offers this piece of advice. Use this black cumin, and you'll never come to heartache. To which the Talmud says, but wait a minute. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said it's one of 60 poisons. And when it sleeps east of its granary, where the wind blows from, where they're storing the black cumin, is liable for his life. It's dangerous. To which he gives an answer. He says, no, what they were doing was, there's a difference between smelling it, and the other is tasting it. Edibles apparently are different from inhaling this black cumin, and Rabbi Yirmiyah's mother used to bake it into bread. And then she would remove it, but there was something that was absorbed within the bread. In other words, this existed with concerns for its safety 2,000 years ago. Generally, black cumin has, just speaking it from a more modern perspective, some neurological impact and is used to relieve pain and depression. Go figure. But yeah, it's not new. Nothing's new. But this is one element, is the issue of safety and the concern for harm. I brought you another example in number 12, which is talking about about Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. There may be, but that's one concern. Second concern goes back to something that Arlene said about confusing your mind. When a person is intoxicated, they end up making poor decisions.
My question is, in Jewish life, drink l'chaim.
Yes, I'm coming back to the drinking. We are definitely not finishing this topic without discussing drinking. It's a must. Not that drinking is a must. Addressing the topic. But you're right, and we have to go there. But the second concern is that when a person is intoxicated, they do make poor decisions. It leads people to lose opportunities for mitzvot from a religious perspective, right? We have a mitzvah. When we are going to eat something, we make a blessing beforehand. When we finish eating, we make a blessing afterwards. Good luck remembering to make the blessing properly afterwards, right? Let's talk about the drinking as one consideration. The person who becomes intoxicated, or the person who is high, and then misses time for services. Right? Now what have they done? And Rabbi Feinstein, in his 1970s responsum on it, mentioned this point in source number 13. He is one of those who discusses it, others do as well. And one point that comes up in this context, and I brought it for you in number 14, is unlike with alcohol, it's very hard to evaluate what is a safe dose when you're dealing with drug use. Cannabis and alcohol, in number 14, acutely impair several driving-related skills in a dose-related fashion. But the effects of cannabis vary more between individuals than they do with alcohol because of tolerance, differences in smoking technique, different absorptions of THC, the active ingredient in marijuana. Detrimental effects of cannabis use vary in a dose-related fashion, are more pronounced with highly automatic driving functions than with more complex tasks that require conscious control, whereas with alcohol produces an opposite pattern of impairment. That's a really fascinating thing. Did you catch that? People who drink and drive are dangerous in one way. People who use drugs and drive are dangerous in the opposite way. For people who use drugs and drive, they're going to have more problems with automatic hits. If they have to concentrate on something that's hard to do, they have to parallel park, they'll do okay. They'll do worse maintaining just normal speed limit and driving normally. Whereas with alcohol, it's the opposite. Apparently, they'll do better on the automatic type things, but when they're actually needed to concentrate, they can't do that. It's a fascinating thing. I don't know the science of it, but it's a remarkable phenomenon. But the point is, with alcohol, there's a basic formula. You know the person's body weight. You know how much they ate. You know the period of time through which they're drinking, and you can more or less calculate what their blood alcohol level is going to be. It doesn't work that way with drug use. There are so many more factors, not to mention it stays in the system so much longer, that you can't do the math in the same way and calculate a safe dose. So that's all within this second issue. Our first issue is medical safety. Our second issue is you're going to be making bad decisions and be out of control, and you can't titrate and figure out how to have a safe dose. And then there's a third issue. This is philosophical. Those who were present at my course that I did in the fall, Life After Death, will find source number 15 familiar. God creates human beings at the beginning of the Torah and presents us first as part of the plant and animal kingdom. Much of the language surrounding the creation of the plants and the animals is the same as that used for human beings. The same verbs are used. We're created out of the ground. Human beings are created as vegetarians. It's not, we don't seem to be terribly special. But then, you get the verse in number 15. And God commanded upon the man, saying, from every tree in the garden you shall eat. Emphasis is not on the business about eating from the tree and not eating from one particular tree. Emphasis is on the first half of the sentence. In the Hebrew, Vayitzav, God commanded upon the man. The word Vayitzav becomes the root of the word mitzvah. It means a commandment. Mitzvah does not mean good deed. Mitzvah means a commandment. But Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik wrote, as I brought you here, number 15, with this verse, God commanded upon the man, God takes man-animal into his confidence, addresses him, and reveals to him his moral will. In other words, human beings at that point become commanded creatures. Not creatures of instinct, not creatures who are trying to satisfy their desires, but instead creatures who have an imperative of, let me put my ethical self ahead of my instinct. I'm not going to act based on what makes me feel good. I'm going to act based on right behavior. And that's what makes the human being something different from the animal kingdom. That's our mandate, to be in a relationship with God. That's why the Torah can tell us that we should be holy. That's why the Torah can tell us do that which is righteous and good. The person who says, I would like to use drugs so that I can free myself from the sense of inhibition, so that I can free myself from the sense of obligation, is going against that original imperative. We were created so that we could superimpose the right over the instinct. A person who says, I want to go the opposite route, is working against the mandate for our creation, the reason for our existence. And so that becomes a third concern. We have the health concern, we have the effects of intoxication concern, and then we have the philosophical concern of, who do you want to be? Do you want to be somebody who is commanded, somebody who has an ethical relationship with the Creator, or do you want to be somebody who is looking to get away from all of that? And then the last point within this section, before we get to the wine question, is you're entering into use of a known addictive substance. Now, not addictive for everybody. The estimates vary at what percentage of the population will more easily become addicted to marijuana use. But it's out there. 10%, I've heard, is one number. The 10% of the population is drawn into addiction more easily. I don't know what the official number is, so to speak. But you put yourself in a position. I'm just checking the time to make sure we're okay. Yes, we are. You put yourself into a position where you could become addicted to, in the thrall of, this drug. Like, why would you want to do that? I know why people want to do it, because they find it enjoyable. I get that. However, from a Jewish perspective, you don't want to be under the control of a drug. You don't want to have that level of a craving. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, in number 17, connects this with the story of the Torah of Ben Sorer Moreh. Ben Sorer Moreh, also known in English as the rebellious child. What's the story of the rebellious child? Sorry? Well, what's the story first before you get to that stage? The rebellious child is described in a passage in Deuteronomy as a young man. Rabbis, based on the read of the text, suggest he's somewhere the end of 12 and 3/4 to 13, somewhere around there, who steals from his parents to go get meat and wine so that he can eat gluttonously, so that he can drink with abandon. And as the Talmud goes through the verses and explains them, it says specifically it's somebody who steals from his parents in order to get this. Because that way the resource is always there to be able to feed and develop the habit. And it's not somebody who gets particularly good meat or particularly good wine. He's just going for whatever he can get. And you start to recognize what they're talking about. The word addiction was not, they weren't speaking English anyway, but the word addiction is not used per se, but it's so clear that it's warning about somebody who, because they have the resources available, starts to get into meat, starts to get into wine, to the point where they can't break out of the habit. And the Talmud warns that because he can't break out of the habit, he's going to go further and further until he's willing to kill somebody in order to feed that habit. Now, mind you, the Talmud also states that based on the laws that are presented there in the Torah, this case can't actually happen. It's describing a hypothetical. It talks about the different rules that are indicated by the biblical verses. It says this is a physical impossibility to actually get to the case, particularly described in the Torah. Then why is it there? So Talmud says, drosh v'kabel sachar, learn it and receive reward, which some commentators explain means it's trying to teach us a lesson. Even if this case can't happen, but in general are the dangers of addiction, and particularly in that context, in the young. That's what it's warning us, so where this can go. So Rabbi Feinstein says, if you take a look at number 17, still in his response to him about drug use, he says it causes great craving, greater than cravings for food and the like, which are necessities for personal survival. Some cannot reduce and eliminate their cravings. This, the serious prohibition stated regarding a rebellious child, regarding his great craving for eating, even though it's for kosher food. Certainly one may not bring himself to even greater craving and for something which a person does not need, this is prohibited, because you're not allowed to put yourself in that kind of position. So that's his fourth, that's the fourth concern out of our four. We're concerned about the harm to health. We're concerned about what people are going to do when they are on the drug. We're concerned about the fact that people are looking to release inhibitions and relax their mind and get out of prohibitions. And we're looking for, we're concerned for entering into use of a known addictive substance. So that explains the stance on drugs. But now, what do you do with alcohol? What are we doing? Why do we have this? What would you say? I'm getting out of my nose. Yeah?
Alcohol can be addictive.
Yeah.
All the same qualities that we just
have. Seems like it. So why is it that we are so much more tolerant? I mean, we're people who would never, ever allow their kids to try this, and people who would never themselves try it, are willing to go that route with wine and whiskey. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a reason. But we're going to come back to that point, actually. Yeah.
Because it's mandated in the Torah.
Bingo. Right? The problem that you have is that you have biblical verses that mandate, indeed, use of wine in ritual. We have Kiddush, you're supposed to commemorate the Shabbat, and we are taught Zohrei Lel Hayayin, commemorate it with wine. So now what do I do? Purim is another example. Purim is its own thing. Maybe we'll have time again to talk about Purim. It's a really good point. I hadn't planned to include it in this, but if we have time at the end, we'll come back to Purim specifically.
We use it for so many celebrations. I mean, you know, we pop the champagne, the weddings, other religions use it.
Right. So Mann points out a separate issue, which is it's so culturally accepted as the way to celebrate. It's true. It's not just the way to celebrate, even. It's the way to blow off steam. Right? Somebody says, oh, I had a terrible day at work. I need a beer. It's just part of the lingo. It's part of the way people talk.
Well, there's no judgmental part to that. In other words, if you say you've had a bad day and you need a beer, I don't think, I think, great.
Thank you. But it's true. I mean, part of it being culturally accepted is that you don't look down on somebody. Right? If you go to the store and you see somebody walking out, now it's in the supermarket, so they see somebody walking out with a six-pack or 24 or whatever it is, you don't say to yourself, wow, that inebriated person, this dissolute kind of person. I'm a judgmental guy.
When you go to Israel and you see the things on the stones carrying the grapes to it's ancient.
It's been part of our culture for millennia. Absolutely true, yes.
I know what a tour in that day is you pick up a fine or a big wine, but it also shows a danger. The Torah shows a danger when it talks about lost daughter and what happens.
Right. So I'm coming right back to that. Right. There's the other side that's found in the Torah as well. So let's get into this topic and figure out what the story is with alcohol. So the first point goes back to what was said about being able to say, to being able to stop effectively. One of the practical differences between alcohol use and drug use is that the goal of use of marijuana is, generally speaking, the high. Right? That's why people do it. Right? People don't say, that smells great. That's not a thing. I once lectured on this topic and mentioned that, and somebody listened to the recording afterwards and emailed me and said, it depends on the kind of leaf and that old one person for whom that's a thing. They, realistically, it may be true that some are seeking a milder buzz and some are seeking to be completely lost. But fundamentally, it's about achieving a state that Judaism views as problematic. When you're dealing with wine, there is such a thing, or whiskey for that matter, as drinking it for the taste and not to affect one's mind. Not everybody who is doing it for the reasons that the Torah is concerned about, and I think that's one reason why we differentiate, and coupled with that, is that it is easier to define a safe dose, as we said, regarding alcohol than it is regarding drugs. So that's number one. Number two is that wine does have a sacred place in Judaism. We mentioned the mitzvah of Kiddush as one point. Someone mentioned the four cups at the Seder as another. Mind you, one could use grape juice. Yeah, you're able to use grape juice. So I want to make sure that's clear. But the drug use doesn't have this kind of sacred role within Judaism. There are those who point out that one of the spices identified with the incense in the temple was called Kinei Bosem, and suggests that Kinei Bosem cannabis. It's cute. But it doesn't have an established sacred place in Judaism. I think that's a second difference. So wine has a pedigree, and wine has a purpose besides getting high. But I think there's a third point that's really important. And that is, Judaism fundamentally recognizes value in inducing oneself to feel better, even if we don't want to go too far. And that's true in the context of discussions about alcohol. You know, if you take a look on your sheet, at source number 18, a classic verse from Psalms. In Hebrew, it's V'yayin yesamach levav enosh. And wine which gladdens the heart of man, making faces shine more than oil does. Wine gladdens the heart of man. And it's not taken in this context as just a description, but it's taken as a prescription. You want to gladden the heart of man, this is a way to do it. Rabbi David Kinkley, right, about 800 years ago, I brought it in source number 18, thinks that when you drink, it can improve your intellect, it can sharpen your mind, because you're in a good mood. Yeah, go figure. I understand the surprise about it, but I actually saw an article last night, I think it was on CNN's website, where they were talking about what's called micro-drug use as a means of sharpening one's mind, that is actually becoming popular. I don't know which circles. But my point is not to say that David Kinkley's position on this is scientific, but rather it's that we are recognizing a value here of being in a better mood. And it's something that one can accomplish with wine in measure, a lot harder to do with drug use. However, at the same time, Jewish literature, biblical literature, is filled with concern for where this leads. And the stories are legion. Where's the first biblical story warning about the dangers of alcohol? Oh, we can do this one. First biblical story about the dangers of alcohol. Noah, right. Noah, post-flood, plants a vineyard, drinks, right? Is drunk and unclothed in his tent and discovered by his children. Like, you don't think this is a warning? Of course this is a warning. Fast forward, you get the story somebody mentioned earlier of Lot and his two daughters, right? And that's as revolting as it gets. But you can move further in the Torah. You can find many others. Right? There's a woman by the name of Hannah who goes to pray at the Mishkan, at the tabernacle, and the high priest sees her, and she is bitter and upset. She has no children, she wants a child, and she's pouring out her heart to God. And the high priest, Eli, misunderstands. And he says, what are you doing here, you intoxicated person? Right? Because what he's conveying is, it's inappropriate for somebody in that state to be addressing God. He is wrong. She's not intoxicated. When you look at the model of the non-Jewish king found in the Bible, you look at, particularly among the Babylonians and Persians, you find Nebuchadnezzar, drinker, Belshazzar, big drinker, Ahasuerus, 180-day party with drinking galore, Mashiach, Kadat, Enones, anybody can drink as much as they want, or as little as they want, but everybody seems to be drinking at his parties. Right? Biblical laws. One is not allowed to drink and then enter the sanctuary. That's a prohibition. A Kohen is not allowed to serve after he's been, after he has been drinking. You find direct moralizing against drinking. Did I bring it here on the sheet? It's hard because my sheets are all torn apart here. But take a look at verse number 20, passage from Isaiah. These people too have erred in wine and wandered in intoxicating drink. The priest and prophet have erred in intoxicating drink, have been swallowed up in wine, have strayed into intoxicating drink, have erred in the seer's words, have stumbled in judgment. For all the tables are filled with vomit and filth without empty space. Pretty clear, no? Pretty clear. And the Talmud warns about the fact that drinking may work for some, but not for others. Verse number 21. Some drink it, and it's good for them, as in the verse we said before, wine which gladdens the heart of man. And some drink it, and it's bad for them. And he quotes a verse in Proverbs, give intoxicating drink to the doomed, and wine to those of bitter spirit. Right? It could be something people enjoy. It also could be something they give to someone who's about to be executed. If you look at verse number 22, fascinating. The Talmud looks at the words in Hebrew for wine. We have two words, yayin and tirosh. And it asks, what can we learn from these words? Yayin is a word that connotes crying and wailing, yilala. Tirosh, because one who starts with wine becomes rush. Rush, not rosh, meaning head, but rush, meaning impoverish. It's a drain on your budget, among other things. It's considered harmful. It's considered a negative. And so when you move forward to the era of the medieval period, and you look at what the rabbis had to say about drinking, you find some very harsh comments. You know, there's a practice that many people have that when they're saying Kiddush, before they say the blessing on the wine, they say something along the lines of Sabrim, or Sabrim Ranan, or Sabrim Ranan Rabbanan Rabbanan. What does the word Sabrim mean? It's Aramaic, although it's connected to certain Hebrew words. It means pay attention. It means pay attention, it means focus. It means Sabrim Ranan. Focus my masters. That's what it means. Why are you asking people to focus at that point? Well, it could be because you're about to do a mitzvah and you want to get everybody's attention. But take a look at source number 23, which comes from students of Rashi. Look at this suggestion. Alternatively, another explanation for why people say this. Because wine causes shame, bringing the person to intoxication, foolishness, and destruction. The text says, we just read it, wine yisamach, the heart of man, it gladdens, and the sages said, if one merits, it gladdens him. If one does not merit, it destroys him. And they make a play on the word yisamach, but I'm not going into that right now. Therefore, one says, pay attention, my masters, meaning, set your minds to drink wine. And he says this, the person who's about to make Kiddush says this, out of fear, lest they come to corruption. We're about to drink. We better stop and think why we're drinking first. Make sure to keep ourselves focused. And thus, he says, that's why you say l'chaim. You want to know why you say l'chaim? He says, to life, meaning our desire and thought is to drink for life, so they not come to corruption. And they reply, amen, l'chaim. That's why we say l'chaim, he suggests, is to say this drinking should be for life, and not the destructive kind of drinking. And so I brought you on the sheet. If you look at 24, Maimonides, he says, gathering for intoxicating drink should be an even greater shame to you than gathering of people without clothing, with their privacy exposed, and so on. It's a little gross. I'm really busy to read. Look at number 25. He says, when a wise person drinks wine, he drinks only enough to irrigate the food in his innards. Anyone who becomes intoxicated is a sinner, degraded, destructive to his own wisdom. Becoming intoxicated in front of laity desecrates God's name. He's pretty clear, right? He's not ambiguous. You know, I just realized that I've gone the entire time without using the paper here, so I better make sure to use it because Marjorie arranged it, and you know, that's important. But what we've now said here, right, is that we have four concerns in general, right? When we mentioned drug use, we were concerned about health. We were concerned about the impact of intoxication. And we got the O. The intoxicatio, it sounds very Italian. We are concerned about the goals, right? Trying to get out from under our obligations. And we were concerned about addiction. Those were the four elements that we outlined when it came to drug use. Does any of these not apply when it comes to wine?
Goals.
Right? Maybe health to a certain extent, depending on how you're drinking.
The goals,
not quite the same, because a person can drink without it being in order to get out from a sense of duty and religious obligation. A person might drink and not get to intoxication, might drink and not get to addiction. I mean, you know, I have finished an adult every week. I don't, you know, go home on a Tuesday and have a drink. So what we're seeing here is that the concerns are present with wine also. The concerns are present certainly in the sources that we just read. However, they're not to the same extent, and they're not 100%. And when you weigh that against the fact that when you're dealing with wine, you have the mitzvah element of it, and you have the goal of increasing joy, which we've said is inherently in Judaism something positive. It's good for you. You end up with a slightly different approach when it comes to drinking. An approach that's not the same as when you're dealing with drugs. But take a look at source number 26. A little more recent than Maimonides. Talking about drinking. He says, the sages obligated intoxication or at least drinking more than normal. He's talking about Purim. To remember the great miracle. And it's true. The sages talk about drinking more than normal. In truth, one who knows regarding himself that he would then degrade any mitzvah, let's say he wouldn't wash properly before eating his meal, or making blessing after meals, he would not pray minchah or maariv after his Purim feast, or he would act lightheaded, better than not become intoxicated. All of one's deeds should be for the sake of heaven. So he argues that people should limit what they're doing on Purim as well, in order to avoid this kind of situation. Purim is not somehow a get out of jail free card. And what we're seeing here, and what I want to draw out of this, is the concerns that are there for drug use are absolutely there for alcohol use. The sages can't go as far in terms of prohibiting, because you do have a mitzvah and you do have the positives of joy. But you get the sense when you read the last sources that we read, right, 24, 25, 26, that they'd be a lot happier if they could simply ban it. There's one other issue which comes up, and here this brings you back to the Kiddush Club phenomenon. If you take a look at source number 27, this is an article written by a friend of mine, by Jonathan Muscat. Alcohol in our synagogues, should our shul go dry? He was talking about a meeting of a group within the synagogue that wanted to consider this question. And he says, some members in our community noted that when a fancy bottle of scotch is put out at a kiddush, it generates a lot of excitement, which is undoubtedly noticed by our teens. Others mentioned that a new liquor store just opened up in the 5 pounds, that's someplace in New York, and they were advertising bottles of scotch valued at over $200. I believe that when it comes to alcohol use, it's more than simply a question of protecting our teens from addiction, drunkenness, and dangerous behavior. It's a question of teaching our teens what we and in turn they should value. What is central and what is ancillary in the eyes of the Torah? What should generate our greatest excitement? Where should we exercise moderation? When our teens see that our excitement for a bottle of the latest scotch far exceeds our excitement for what shul is really supposed to be about, Torah and Tefillah, prayer, then they receive a twisted message about what are and what are not the central values of our synagogues. It's true that wine plays a significant role in Jewish ritual life, but it almost always is featured in an ancillary role, not the central role. When we celebrate a marriage ceremony, we add significance to the ceremony by reciting a blessing over wine. When we celebrate a Brit Milah, we add significance to the ceremony by reciting a blessing over wine. When we sanctify Shabbat, we add significance to the sanctification by reciting a blessing over wine. In all these instances, the wine is meant to enhance something which is worthy of our celebration, but it's not the central event. And certainly in a synagogue setting, our communal holy space, we should clarify to our teens and to ourselves, frankly, what is central and what is not in our lives. And I think he's really hitting on a major point here, which is beyond the four concerns that we mentioned here, and beyond, if you look at the review questions that I added at the bottom, the reasons why we may be more tolerant of wine, the three reasons, right? The mitzvah, the ability practically to keep it in check, the fact that people drink it and it's not necessarily for getting high, and I guess I have four reasons really. The fact that we value being in a more joyous state. Despite all of that, you have to ask yourself, what am I spending on, and what kind of message is that going to send to my children? Or a person who's in the synagogue and says, I think I'm going to leave prayers now because I want to go have a drink. Right? I think also that raises serious questions about what you are communicating, about the relative value of what you're doing there in the synagogue. So I think, I feel like I'm ending on a down note, and I'm sorry to do it, but I think that that's responsibly where this goes. I see two questions. Hang on just a second. But it's okay. So my verb is they speak about humor next week, and that'll be a safer way to feel good. I think that the humor piece of it is very important. I'm going to take two questions now, and then I'll stick around for a minute or two afterwards also. But I think that it has to end with a cautionary note, in the sense that even if alcohol is sanctioned, the Bible itself and Jewish law itself are really conflicted about it and have those kinds of reservations. Yes?
I've